Welcome to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answers. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev, an emergency and addiction doctor who has served at the White House and still practices on the front lines. Right here on High Truths, you will learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. To grow this community of information and action, I hope you give us a five-star review. Come visit me on hightruths.com to learn more about the show or download a free prescription for naloxone. Carrying naloxone for drugs is like carrying an EpiPen for allergies. Today's episode is sponsored by Physicians for Healthy Communities, a physician-led organization that educates on the science of prevention to improve public health. Visit their website to learn how they prevent substance misuse while supporting individuals, families, and communities. Go to physiciansforhealthycommunities.org. Hello again, High Truth listeners. Get ready for a public health conversation. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev. Public health was not a household word before the COVID-19 pandemic. Public health is now famously or infamously associated with masks, vaccines, and contact tracing. As an emergency physician, I have always had great respect for the importance of public health. In the emergency department, I have the front seat view of society's problems, from car crashes to infections to drugs and alcohol. I treat disease and injuries, but that is precisely what drives the need to prevent illnesses and injuries so they never happen in the first place. I want less business, not more. This is where public health comes in. My listeners know that I have been jealous of gonorrhea and chlamydia. These sexually transmitted illnesses get zip code mapping, contact tracing, and a regular budget. I'm jealous of salmonella diarrhea that received housing intervention. And of course, I'm jealous of COVID-19 that received an all-out government response to prevent disease and vaccines and treatment with medications that received unprecedented fast-tracking. I believe the infectious disease and public health model applied to monkeypox and COVID can apply to fentanyl and addiction. To learn more about public health, I reach out to Dr. Gary Tsai. Dr. Gary Tsai is a physician executive specializing in both psychiatry and addiction medicine, who is the director of Substance Abuse Prevention and Control, a division of the Los Angeles County Department of Public Health. In this role, he is responsible for leading nearly 500 staff with a budget of approximately $460 million for the 10 million residents of Los Angeles County. Dr. Tsai also serves on the board of directors of NAMI. He founded Forgotten Films, a film production company focusing on social issue projects and behavioral health. His first film, Voices, premiered on public television and was awarded a SAMHSA Voice Award. He's also an award-winning author of Against All Odds, a practical guide to successfully navigate psychosis and behavioral health systems. To learn more about Dr. Gary Tsai, his movies and book, check out High Truth show notes. Dr. Gary Tsai, welcome to High Truths.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
It's happy to connect again. I met you many years ago, back in the good old days of prescription opioid deaths. Do you remember that?
I do.
We were like screaming that there were 100 deaths a day. And now, like, we wish there were, because we're now at 300 deaths a day with fentanyl. And at the time, we started the Prescription Drug Abuse Task Force in San Diego and trying to do the same thing in LA. And I remember gathering the names and phone numbers and contacting 72 emergency departments in LA County. That was a lot.
We are a big county, a lot of hospitals.
It was amazing. I got to know LA through that project. And at that time, I don't know if that was the beginning of for you getting involved in the issue as well, but we started Safe LA, Safe RX LA, I think it was. I think I bought the first domain website name for the county for that project.
Yeah, Safe Med LA. I mean, I had been working with the Substance Abuse Prevention Control for some time before that. But, you know, that was, it was our opioid coalition to try to address prescription drug abuse and the opioid epidemic at the time. Important work, and I appreciated your help in, with that.
Yeah, that was interesting. I think that was the start of really coalition building across California and across the country. And I hold on to that because it was the parents who were victims who started and organized all that at first. And I continue to do that and follow their lead to this day. But then it was another conference where I was invited to LA to speak, and you were there. You were a speaker too. And I was amazed by you and how you very bravely spoke about your mom and your family. And we talk about stigma for drugs, but I think there may be even a stronger stigma for mental health. And you just, you know, told the whole world as a physician that your mom had schizophrenia.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's part of my life and my history. You know, I don't consider it being brave just because I never felt ashamed about, you know, my mom. But I did grow up with a mom with schizophrenia. I think it shaped the reason why I went into psychiatry. And I think it shaped the reason why I'm interested in systems level work, because a lot of the challenges that my family had weren't clinical challenges. It wasn't like we didn't have the right medications or she wouldn't respond to the medications. It was the system wasn't structured to help my mom. And so that's really what got me on my journey towards administrative systems level work. While she didn't have any substance use, I ended up working in the substance use space just because a lot of similarities there in terms of working with disenfranchised populations with a condition that's highly stigmatized. And I, you know, naturally gravitated to that and all of the opportunities to improve the addiction field.
Yeah. And then you, okay, and you studied psychiatry, but then also became board certified in addiction medicine. I'm wondering if you did that like me, I grandfathered into addiction medicine, or if you did it through the psychiatry route.
No, I grandfathered in through the American Society of Addiction Medicine, and now it's through the Preventative Medicine Board.
Right. Okay. We did the same pathway, which is, it's kind of interesting for me is emergency medicine. Just when I went into emergency medicine, it was a fairly new field, and now addiction medicine, new field. So I see the profession kind of growing in a similar way.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, for what it's worth, I was actually headed towards emergency medicine from the beginning of my medical school career. And then, you know, I naturally gravitated towards psychiatry just because of my background growing up with my mom. But emergency medicine was something I was very interested in as well.
Interesting. Actually, I was backwards. I think if you asked me in high school, I wanted to be a psychiatrist, and then I became an emergency physician. But the other thing that makes you, I think, stand out and so special is that you've taken the work that comes from, you know, personal place to work on systems approach, but also maybe because you're from Los Angeles and Hollywood, but you've taken the artistic method of getting the message heard. And I loved what I was able to see of the movies that you produced called Voices of Mental Health. Can you share with us a little bit about that?
Yeah, definitely. It definitely wasn't in pursuit of Hollywood. You know, it was actually more due to the fact that I was in residency training at the time. I was relatively impatient. I wanted to make an impact, in particular on how
that's the ER
view.
Doc in you.
That's right.
The impatient part.
That's right. you know, I wanted to make an impact on how people thought about, felt about, and saw people with serious mental illness. And so, you know, I knew that film was a great opportunity to reach people. You know, did a Kickstarter, got some funding there, had a SAMHSA grant, and then, you know, did a documentary on three individuals living with psychosis, very different backgrounds. One is a Vietnamese family whose the mother in that family had psychosis, schizophrenia. Another one is a homeless Black individual in San Francisco. Another one is the family of someone who had untreated schizophrenia and ended up shooting and killing two people up in Northern California. Three very different stories. The tie is psychosis. And the aim of the film is really to humanize the condition. You know, I've long felt that if people thought about and felt about people with psychosis and schizophrenia the same way that family members feel about them, that there'd be less stigma, more compassion, better policies and programs.
I think you accomplished that because I definitely watched it and connected with the characters. Like this homeless guy is such a nice, friendly guy and with a beautiful smile, despite like only like one tooth there.
Yeah. That project also gave me a lot of insight into what real filmmakers do. I'm not a real filmmaker. I made a film, but you know, fundamentally I'm a physician, but a lot of work. A lot of money, a lot of dedication, and you know, kudos to all the filmmakers out there because it's not easy.
Yeah. So you did this back in 2014, 10 years ago. How have things changed in mental health?
Well, there's a lot more focus on it now, which is a good thing. There's also some more funding focused on it. While there is stigma associated with mental health conditions, I think it is less than back when I did the film, but you know, it's still there. So we still have work to do, but I do think that there's been some positive progress. And you know, I see similarities with respect to where substance use systems are. I see substance use systems as being behind a lot of stigma, a lot of disenfranchisement in terms of people who are affected, and similar opportunities in terms of advancing the substance use field in similar ways as the mental health field has been advanced.
Yeah. If you had to do the film again today, would it be the same characters or have the people changed?
So, you know, to be frank, it was very difficult to find the right individuals because originally I had wanted to do a film primarily on homeless individuals with psychosis. And as we went forward, we realized it was difficult to find individuals who were able to tell their story in a cohesive way that could be captured on film without, you know, needing hours and hours of footage to do that, to do so. And so we kind of ended up with the three characters in a very lucky way. And so I think if I was to do a film today on psychosis, it probably would be similar. I like the fact that we portrayed three very different stories with similar common threads. And, you know, fundamentally, I still believe that we want to humanize people with these conditions and that that is the path forward in terms of changing hearts and minds and, you know, getting better laws, more funding, better programs to serve these individuals.
You know, as you're talking, I'm thinking about your movie and how it could really help people today. Slightly different bent, but the New York Times had an article about this young boy, 17 years old, Nick Kelly, who's smoked a marijuana vape and then developed an acute psychotic reaction and jumped off a building to his death. And the experts say, oh, this is so rare. This is unusual. And yet I know that I know hundreds of parents whose children have gone under psychosis, and it's not that rare, and it's something that people need to know about. I was thinking about, like, I think if I did a movie or a film like you did right now and copied you, I'd do that for those parents to realize that they're not alone.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, cannabis is, in some ways, it's very, very old, right? It's been around for a long time. But I think with the amount and potency of cannabis that's available now, it's very different. And, you know, I can say as a psychiatrist, as a father, I do have a lot of concerns about the wide scale availability of cannabis and the implications on, in particular, young minds, right? Because there are associations with psychosis that I think have been pretty well proven at this point. And, you know, we're in a situation with cannabis policy where the policy is ahead of the science. And, you know, that's a bit scary. I think it's important that we be mindful of that moving forward.
I think it's more than scary. It's deadly, and we're sadly seeing the consequences. So if you remember me from back in the opioid prescription days, at the time I was reaching out, it was still not mainstream to curb your opioid prescriptions, right? I was going not with the tide. I was one of the first to see that. Now, you know, everybody realizes that's a problem. And I did that because I connected with the parents and their children were victims of opioid prescriptions. And now, history is repeating itself with parents who are, their children have become victims of high potency marijuana. I want to promote your book, Against All Odds. Who is this written for? Is this for patients, parents, doctors?
So it's written for everyone, but I would say that probably the primary audience would be families seeking help for a loved one, in particular with serious mental illness and other behavioral health conditions. You know as well as I, healthcare is extraordinarily complex, and it can be very difficult to navigate the system. I had to navigate it for my mom. And as a psychiatrist, I had difficulty. And I had social workers who I consulted with who also had difficulty. And so the book is really written to help people navigate this large ball of yarn we call our behavioral health systems.
Against All Odds. So check that out. LA County, 10 million people. It's like the size of several different states. It's a lot. And you're managing the trifecta of homelessness and drugs and both mental health. As a public health official, somebody, like you said, dealing with systems, how do you manage the three? It seems like people are taking each one individually instead of looking at the collective.
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, you know, my agency is primarily focused on substance use, but we work very closely with our sister Department of Mental Health and with our housing partners, right? We have the LA Housing Services Authority. We also have the Department of Health Services Housing for Health program. And so, you know, I don't think that there's a single entity that would be able to tackle all of those very complex issues. And so really it's collaboration partnership across those areas. I would say though, there's a lot of overlap between, you know, homelessness, mental health conditions, substance use conditions. We have a lot of people with co-occurring conditions. We have a lot of the same social drivers that drive people toward, homelessness as, mental health conditions and substance use. So, a lot of overlap. I think one of the strategies is look for the common thread to try to address you know, the root causes, right, of those issues. You know, it's not always possible, but, you know, that's the aim.
Yeah. I liken the infectious disease model. I don't know what your take is on it, but my listeners know that I've always been very jealous of sexually transmitted infections, very jealous of COVID and the attention that it get and the public health perspective that it get, like in prevention, in treatment, in contact tracing. And always thought that we can apply those same principles to drugs and addiction. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, as you were talking, I was thinking about overdose mapping and, you know, basically the ability of data to help inform our prevention, certainly like overdose prevention efforts, but also broader prevention efforts and treatment efforts so that we're tailoring interventions to where we're experiencing problems. You know, I certainly think that that's a promising approach to try to address some of these root causes.
Right. We do that with gonorrhea, right? That's what I said. What you have mapping. We know that this is the, you know, 92103 zip code is where we need to be more aware of syphilis and test more for that and treat more for that. We did that with monkeypox really effectively. And I do think that we can do that with drugs. Each person who dies, there's a circle of people who are at risk of dying, right? Just like we had that with COVID.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think with a lot of the populations that I care about in terms of the safety net population, there are people who are isolated, but oftentimes even those who are isolated have communities around them. And, you know, being able to tap into those communities so that our interventions are targeting both individuals as well as the broader group. That's the aim of systems level healthcare.
Yeah, I love that. There's new law in effect now in California, SB 43, that expanded the mental health hold. We call it in California 5150, people who are either suicidal, homicidal, or gravely disabled. And what this law does, just for our listeners, I'm sure you're aware, is that it expands what gravely disabled means to include severe substance use disorder, severe mental health use disorder. How are you as a county managing that? I think that it's scary to a lot of people. It's like, wait, maybe a great percentage of the people who are homeless have severe mental health disorder, severe addiction. Do we now hold all those people in the emergency departments, in the hospitals, at the detriment of not having room for the next heart attack patient?
Yeah, you know, I think the key word is balance for me in terms of how I think about Senate Bill 43 or SB 43. A lot of attention and focus being paid on it right now. You know, just finished a presentation about it actually today. You know, I think that counties are approaching this from a lens of opportunity. I think that there are some challenges in terms of how complex it is, and also, you know, the level of change that was introduced, because now individuals can be placed on those 5150 holds because of severe substance use disorders, personal safety, or necessary medical care. And so it really does broaden the door for people who are eligible to meet that grave disability definition. And I think that some of the things that we have to be mindful on on the substance use side is we don't want to close people off to disclosing their substance use, right? If someone gets placed on a hold and has a really bad experience, which unfortunately is not uncommon when it comes to 5150s, you know, they may be more reluctant to share their substance use history in the future or to seek help, right? And that's counterproductive. We don't want that. And so the real opportunity with Senate Bill 43, I think, is to try to translate some of those involuntary holds into voluntary services and necessary services moving forward.
Yeah, it could be challenging. I remember one patient I had who was brought in by law enforcement as a psychotic, gravely disabled, and he was not mentally well, maybe from drugs or his underlying mental health or both, methamphetamine to speak of, but he had his hands all covered up, and I thought, you know, anything that's covered, I go like, I wonder what's underneath there. And I unwrapped all these bandages were on his hands, and his fingers were literally falling off. With his rings so tight, and he had necrosis. He needed surgery, and he didn't want it. He didn't want to be there. He didn't think anything was wrong. He barely allowed me to take off his bandages. He did it. I had to, like, you know, really entice him to do that. I kept him on a hold, admitted him to the hospital, called the surgeon, mental health, addiction, everyone, all our specialties, and we have everything in our emergency departments. We're very blessed with that. And at the end of the day, when I'm checking on how did he do several days later, they let him go with his necrotic fingers, and he refused to consent to have any of those services that we were ready to offer him. So it can be tough.
There are some really difficult cases that, you know, we're hoping Senate Bill 43 can be helpful with, while also balancing out. There are also, you know, equity implications that we need to consider in terms of implementing SB 43. So yeah, really complex issues.
Yeah. What about the principle in housing of housing first? Southern California has 50% of all the unsheltered homeless people in the entire United States. So you see that in LA, I see that in San Diego. And there's a principle of housing first, and then we'll figure out it. The other problems, the mental health, the addiction problems. And I had an interesting conversation with a gentleman who was homeless, came out of that, and now he advocates for the homeless. And he is actually against that principle of housing first, that he feels that that's not compassionate, that you actually should have conditions to give people hope to get them out of being homeless, out of their mental health problem, out of their addiction. And I'm wondering what you think about that.
Yeah, you know, it's a great question. I've had a number of conversations with housing partners about this. You know, overall, I think that there are people who are helped by Housing First, and there probably are also people who would do better in other housing environments, right? And so for me, what it really speaks to is the importance of us having a full continuum of housing options, Housing First models, as well as recovery-oriented models. And so when I say recovery-oriented housing, I'm referring to environments where people, aren't able to use substances, you know, do have to maintain abstinence. But I think that there's a way that we can implement recovery-oriented housing in a low barrier way as well, so that we're not just focused on kicking people out as soon as they use substances, right? I think that the whole impetus for Housing First was because there was a realization that, you know, people were being kicked out of housing environments for exhibiting symptoms of the conditions that they had, and, you know, wanting to treat housing as a part of health. And so I do see value personally. I see a lot of value in Housing First. At the same time, I also think that we should be ensuring a broad continuum of housing approaches. And so right now, you know, my understanding is across most housing systems, they're primarily Housing First options, right? And while I think that that does need to be the majority of housing available, I think there's a role for recovery-oriented housing as well.
I like your broad approach, because I gave another story from the emergency department. Alex Soto, may he rest in peace, was one of my favorite homeless people. We'd see him every single week, multiple times a week in the emergency department. He was homeless on methamphetamine, terrible schizophrenia, and he finally got housing. And there at the housing, he overdosed on fentanyl. So, like, what good did we do? While he really, I don't know, he was to me the picture of our failed society, where he needed not just housing, he needed, you know, food, shelter, medications, a safe environment, and to get off drugs to even get a chance. And he never got that opportunity. So, but I like your suggestion of, you know, different options. Let's talk fentanyl. I'm sure you're doing a lot of things about fentanyl with treatment and partnerships. What's happening in LA in terms of that?
Yeah, you know, a lot going on. Our latest overdose numbers, 3,200 people a year in Los Angeles County are dying of overdoses, amounts to about 8 to 9 per day. About half of those are fentanyl related, and the other half are methamphetamine related. There's overlap between those two because people could be using both substances. I think it's so important to highlight. We are in the worst overdose crisis in history, right? It's never been worse. We've also seen some glimmers of hope in terms of our 2022 numbers showed a downward or slowed trend, right? So it hasn't yet gone down, but it's definitely slowed. And so we're anxious to see what the 2023 numbers look like. At a human level, we're hearing from our treatment providers. We're hearing from families about the tragedies and how they're impacting them. And I think that, you know, we're approaching it from a spectrum lens, meaning, you know, we think that prevention and investing upstream is really important, particularly investing in our youth. We're also focused heavily on harm reduction interventions, particularly for people who are very high risk now, people who are using drugs, in addition to significantly expanding our treatment system. We've expanded our treatment system investments by almost 300% since 2017. Basically, every level of care that we offer has expanded in addition to our prevention and harm reduction expansions. So really, we're investing across the board to try to address both the upstream and downstream. And there's glimmers of hope that our overdose numbers are starting to look a little bit better, but still a lot of work to do.
a lot of work to do. Remember, like I started out our conversation with the good old days when only we would have a third of the deaths that we have today. I'm wondering if what we're seeing, because we're seeing that I think nationwide, is a ceiling versus kind of going down. I just kind of want to like compare a little bit of notes between San Diego and Los Angeles. Do you have the naloxone vending machines around the county like we do?
Yeah, we do. It's great, good for counties to learn from each other and to copy what's working from each other. We have vending machines. We're in the process of actually expanding access, but they started in our jails, actually, for people who are being released back into the community who are also at very high risk. So we do have the vending machines.
Yeah, same with us. Started with the jails and also now in different high-risk areas and some private, non-county funded locations such as colleges have put on the vending machines as well. That's kind of downstream, right? And I would love to hear more of what you're doing upstream. One of the initiatives that we have in San Diego that I'm just really proud of, our district attorney, Summer Steffen, who's really invested now a whole year in creating evidence-based programs that are proven to be placed in schools as far as primary prevention. We want our youth to be learn how to live with life's adversities without reaching for drugs, with learning healthier methods. So, uphill from fentanyl, I would say is marijuana, because when I ask my patients what's the first drug you've ever used, it's usually marijuana. But upstream from marijuana is, emotional resiliency and teaching that skills. There are programs that have shown, double-blind control trials. Kids who got this education got better, academic achievement, less violence, less drug addiction, and the kids who did get, those who did and didn't get the treatment. So those programs are available. They're evidence-based, and really looking forward to see this year how they're implemented in San Diego County. And I'd love to hear more about your primary prevention programs.
Yeah, I mean, that's exciting to hear what you're doing in San Diego. I would say that our programs are similarly, heavily focused on youth in schools. So we have student well-being centers where we have health educators situated in certain high schools across the county, talking about substance use education, prevention, talking about naloxone. Some of those sites also have sexual health education as well, basically providing a safe place for kids at school to go to. We're also investing in positive youth development programs, which are similar to what you had described, I think. Youth leadership opportunities for them to shape policies at their school and the community, for them to sit on different commissions and committees, basically trying to cultivate an environment where they're less likely to turn to things like substance use. The beauty of positive youth development, from my perspective, is you're able to target not just one thing. So if you provide those positive youth experiences, it's not just minimizing the likelihood of substance use. It also minimizes the likelihood of mental health conditions, trauma, gun violence, et cetera.
Bullying, everything, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So, that's a little bit of our work around upstream preventative approaches.
Yeah, I think that is very important. If I look at how, in a systems level, how we managed our successes, and we've had successes with tobacco, we've had successes with opioid prescriptions, we manage the population that has the addiction. That's important, like people who are smoking, helping smoking cessation, and the people who came in with a bucket of medications are like, okay, I've got to just figure out how to keep you alive. I can't just take them all away. But the success where we really moved the needle was preventing the next generation of smoking, of becoming addicted to drugs. And that's where that primary prevention is so important, as well as the supply. And as a public health official, you're not really managing the supply, but I think that's really big too.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, studies have shown that for every dollar we invest in prevention, we're saving seven, right? So that's a really good investment.
Very good. Thank you. You speak my language. We're both from California, so we have to talk about methamphetamine. There's no medical-assisted treatment for methamphetamine. There is a new drug coming out that I just have to pitch to you. It's not FDA approved yet, but I'm very excited about it. It's called CS1103. It's a sequestrant, kind of like the drug Sugammadex, which is a drug that sequesters some of the anesthesia medications that's used. So they've done studies in animals, and within minutes of getting this medication, CS1103 grabs a methamphetamine, disables it. So within minutes, you see, you know, change in behavior, and then you excrete it within a couple hours. So that's something on the horizon for acute toxicity. Doesn't help with addiction. But in general, we really don't have any medications, but we do have contingency management. And I'm wondering what LA is doing with your, like you said, half the deaths are from methamphetamine or associated with methamphetamine.
Yeah, I mean, just on the medication front, I have been talking to my UCLA colleagues about the medication you just mentioned, the sequestrant. Very excited. I think we need more tools in our toolbox, right? And so I think that's exciting. We've also had a lot of conversations locally about off-label medications for methamphetamine. They're not FDA approved yet, but there is some evidence to demonstrate that certain medications or combinations of medications, you know, can be helpful. Again, you know, we view that as just an extra potential tool in our toolbox. In terms of contingency management, I mean, you know, kudos to the state. California was the first state in the nation to be approved for a federal waiver to fund contingency management through Medicaid, otherwise known as Medi-Cal in California. You know, and contingency management is basically providing incentives. They can be, you know, financial gift cards, for example, but they could also be other types of incentives to help to promote engagement in treatment.
And like engagement, housing could be an
exactly. And you know, I think that from the early you know, year of the pilot so far, things have gone very well. Our providers have had a lot of positive things to say about their engagements with clients improving as a result of this contingency management tool. And it's one of the few evidence-based practices for methamphetamine. So certainly promising, and we're excited about it.
So is that something that's ubiquitous in addiction clinics? Is every addiction clinic in Los Angeles offering contingency management, or is this very selective?
Right now, it's opt-in. So as a county, we opted in. And agencies can choose to participate. Right now, the pilot in California is primarily for non-residential settings. And so I think the aim is to demonstrate outcomes and to expand, hopefully, from there.
Right. Yeah, I think and it's the one thing that has been shown, again, data wise to really make a difference, even more than any of the medications. So I'd love to see how that's used more often. Now let's talk about what we kind of started talking about, which is marijuana. Again, I like talking about marijuana because it's something other people are not talking about. It's so known to be like, it's safe, it's okay, everybody thinks it's not a problem. And yet you and I, through our work, know that that's just not the case, that the industry has gone untethered with the potency of drugs that are out there at the very heavy cost of our society. We're seeing record number of pediatric poisonings, right? That's the number one poisoning of emergency departments in the entire United States is children under the age of 5. These are not kids with a substance use disorder, or they're not addicted to marijuana. They were poisoned. We're seeing a 1,000% increase in adults because we're saying, oh, this is healthy for you. Use it for whatever you have. But now you're on a blood thinner. You're adding THC to it. You could bleed to death. People don't know this. And then when people want to quit, like they have come into the emergency department, they have cannabis hyperemesis syndrome, they need to quit. And I ask, can you quit? I say, oh yeah, I can quit. And they're in next week because it's not easy. It's very addicting. And we don't have tools. This is one thing I'd love to pitch you on as public health officials. We have tools on how to quit tobacco. We're starting to get tools on how to quit vaping. There's nothing out there for how to quit marijuana. Consistently. And yet, if we look at, you know, youth rehab centers, the number one drug is marijuana. So individually and as a county, what do you think can be done?
Yeah, I mean, this is a complicated issue. I think that education is always a good starting place in terms of understanding that society already has a certain view of cannabis. And like you said, it's largely benign, right? We know that the cannabis today is different than the cannabis from the 60s. And it is more likely to contribute to psychosis, psychiatric effects, it can also have lung effects, cardiac effects as well, particularly if you're smoking. And so that's information that we need to continue to talk more and more about as cannabis is more and more common across our communities. I think that there is a under recognition of the risks. And I think, what's scariest is just the degree to which policies are ahead of the science. And so, one of the things that we've talked about and was excited to hear about was at the federal level and an exploration of potentially re-looking at what schedule cannabis is in, because right now it's Schedule One, right? Which is like the most strict of all.
That's a side
drugs.
Conversation. That's a whole nother topic. Go ahead.
But, I think the point is we'd like to be able to do the research so that the science can catch up with where we are with the policies. Until we do that, we think it makes sense to be judicious in terms of our cannabis policies, right? I think from my perspective, cat's out of the bag in terms of, cannabis is legal in obviously a number of different states. That's fine. I think there are positives from that, right? But I think communities need to understand what the risks are. And particularly if you're under age 25, people oftentimes say 21, but I would say better 25.
I like that.
There are some very, very real risks for how cannabis can impact your brain in a very negative way. And, some of those risks are for decades or for life, right? If someone becomes psychotic and develops schizophrenia as a result of their cannabis use, which I have seen as a psychiatrist over and over, that can be a lifelong condition. And so there are a lot of implications from that.
Right. And it interacts with your psychiatric medications and preventing them from work. So that complicates things even further. A couple things. One is just because you mentioned the scheduling. I wasn't going to get into that debate, but I've given that a lot of thought. I did a whole podcast just on the rescheduling issue. And I think it comes to a real danger, not of the marijuana, but the integrity of the FDA process and what is a medication for and us to continue to have faith in this gold standard of what is a medicine. We haven't done that to any plant. It's different if we wanted to reschedule THC or CBD and go through the FDA process. But for some plant, for political or financial reason, to have that skirt the FDA process, I think is a real existential threat on the integrity of medicine. And that's why, that's a main reason opposing it. And then we also like, what is marijuana? Is it that 90% THC in a vape pen? Is that Schedule Three, really? Or is that more like methamphetamine? So we haven't even defined it. Anyway, so I just wanted to mention that there's a fix to be made with marijuana, but that's not rescheduling is not it. In California, we've tried 3 times and failed in the state. And I'm wondering if I could pitch you on this as well, but we tried as a coalition really with these parents and drug prevention groups labeling marijuana, like we have labels for tobacco, like we have labels for alcohol, like we have labels on, movies with flashing lights. That was killed by the industry. Then we tried a candy ban, like why do we need Weedos that look like Cheetos, really? And we have all the data on pediatric poisoning. Like, why do we need these candies? And that failed. And then I tried, okay, we failed with the labels, we failed with the candies. How about going to the pharmacies? And we actually did a study. Would people want labels on their medications, on their blood thinners, on their blood pressure medicines, on their psychiatric medicines, like don't use this with marijuana, just like it says don't use this with alcohol, don't use with grapefruit juice. Physicians, pharmacists, patients have no idea about that. And it would be very simple to implement that among pharmacies. And then I didn't get traction and kind of pushback from the Pharmacy Association. But one of these days, we will have the right person pushing these causes for public. These are public health measures, right?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I mean, because you may know more about this than I do, but in recent conversations with our team, I thought that there were certain labeling requirements. For example, things couldn't look attractive to youth around cannabis. But are you talking about kind of more specific labeling?
Yeah, we want, well, the labeling issue was to create a label, evidence-based label like we have for tobacco on packaging, like with certain font size, certain colors. There are rules really written by the industry themselves to protect themselves. And there is a law that things cannot be attractive to kids. Walking to a dispensary and telling me that all these colorful things aren't attractive to kids. They're so attractive to kids.
Well, I think that's the thing that we've encountered is that there's a lot of work to actually enforce the current laws and regulations. And I think that's one of the areas that we're focusing on more. I think that it's always challenging if the industry is the main one policing itself. So I certainly agree that, a balanced approach in terms of how to ensure public health, and I would say, physical health, mental health, and public health, because, there are implications on all of those, makes right. a lot of sense.
We really had this outbreak, I think in LA too, of kids at school getting exposed to marijuana edibles and ending up in the emergency department. And I think one of the solutions, I don't know if it's the right solution, was to ensure child protective packaging, voluntarily for parents. But again, that's one of the things. You need to be locking up just like we did. It takes us back to where we were 20 years ago. Lock up your opioids and lock up your cannabis so your little kids don't get into it.
Yeah, I mean, when it comes to edibles too, I just think it's important to highlight paying attention to how much THC or cannabis is in a cookie is important, right? Because when people see a cookie, people generally eat the whole cookie. They don't pay attention to the fact that there may be 5 servings of cannabis in that cookie. And so, I think that's just really important.
Right. And then you don't feel the effect right away. And then you could end up jumping off a building with acute psychosis. And sadly, we have seen that. How to quit campaigns. I'd love to see that. How to quit, assistance for people that there is that need. And the overlap with drugs and mental health takes us to your work as a psychiatrist with mental health. And you're on the board of NAMI, the main organization to help educate on mental health. And I'm wondering, with your work on NAMI, do you overlap on the issues of like psychosis, schizophrenia, as well as drugs, specifically methamphetamine and marijuana?
Yeah, there's definitely some overlap. I think that, NAMI, first and foremost, I think is a mental health organization, but as mental health and substance use become more integrated into behavioral health systems, NAMI's increasingly focused on substance use more and more. There's also just a recognition that, sometimes substance use can lead to long-term schizophrenia, right? And it's not always possible or even necessary to kind of separate those issues out. NAMI started from family members, right? Just like myself, as a son of a mother with schizophrenia. And so, addressing all of those issues is really important.
I think there could be a lot more cooperation, especially when it comes to cannabis with NAMI and awareness. So if we, according to large, huge population-based studies, like 7 million people in Denmark, if we targeted men between the ages of, 12 and 30 and prevented cannabis use, we could decrease 30% of the schizophrenia out there. Like, this is huge. And this is a huge overlap. If we wanted to do one thing to decrease schizophrenia in our crisis, that's one thing we could do. There's a study just came out recently this month from Canada, again, 11,000 people, large-based study, that shows between the ages of 12 and 19, there's 11-fold increase in a risk of psychosis for cannabis use at that age group. Huge. And then I don't know if you've done this for Los Angeles, but I did it for San Diego. I copied Colorado and looked at the drug found on autopsy of kids under the age of 25 who died by suicide. And the number one drug, like almost twice as much as alcohol, is THC. So those kind of statistics, I think if we shared with our NAMI community, because they're much more powerful, could bring awareness, can decrease mental health problems in our society.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. I could say as a psychiatrist, one of my grave concerns is the 5 to 10 year implications of cannabis, what we're going to see down the line in 5 to 10 years as far as schizophrenia rates, right? Rates of psychosis. And so I think that those are very legitimate concerns. I can see there being future opportunities for us to, work together to focus on that preventative messaging as a way to mitigate the downstream, mental health effects, to your point.
That's awesome. So Dr. Tsai, where do you go from here? Tell me what Los Angeles is working on, the primary issue right now.
So I don't know there's a single primary issue, but I can say one of the things that we're really excited about is our Reaching in 95% initiative. And what I mean by that is that the vast majority of people with substance use disorders are not accessing treatment or services. And 95% of those who are not accessing treatment or services are saying that they're not interested or don't think that they need it. Right. And so our Reaching a 95% initiative, or R95 initiative, is really focused on ensuring that our system's designed not just for the 5% of people who are knocking on our treatment doors, but for that 95% who really should be but aren't. Right. And so it's focused on things like establishing lower barrier policies so that more people would be able to access services. I think one of the things that we've talked about, and I'd be interested in your thoughts on this, is that in many instances, the communities have defined readiness for treatment as synonymous with readiness for abstinence. And so even if you have someone who reduced their use of, alcohol from 6 days a week to 2 days a week, there have been instances where people have been turned away because, 2 days a week isn't abstinence, right? And we think that that needs to be addressed in order to broaden our door to get more people into services. Also, looking at policies around discharging when people relapse, right? It doesn't make a whole lot of sense to kick people out for exhibiting the symptoms of their condition. Reaching 95% is about finding every way we can to entice people into services, including looking at things like service design, where we're trying to make our treatment settings more welcoming, warmer, less kind of sterile white lighting, more warm lighting. Similar to what pediatric dentists do, right? Because I have a toddler at home now. And I went to a pediatric dentist for him recently, right? And you go in and you realize,
Mr. Slurpee is there to suck your suction, your mouth.
Yeah, and it looks completely different, right? There's screens all over the place, right? The machines look like trees, right? It's because they're trying to entice people to accept a service that they don't really want, right? And I think that in a lot of ways, that's what we're doing on the substance use side.
I like that. I've given that thought. I like what you're saying, R95. And I did that. We talked about that a lot when I was at ONDCP. We called it the treatment gap. Only 10% of the people who need it get treatment. But the caveat is understanding that statistics. who at a treatment facility, right? But there's 20 million people who are in recovery. Not all of them went to a treatment facility. So that tells me the gap, the treatment gap, is not just about treatment. So there are many people, like you said, who we as clinicians know that they need help and they're not ready to get it. We only have one way for them to get treatment. We have, okay, do you want some Suboxone and Naloxone and some contingency management? This all we have available for them. That's all we know. Me too. I'm a doctor. That's all I have. But I realize, looking at the 20 million people in recovery, that's not the only path to recovery. And we could argue whether it's complete abstinence or not. But, I mean, that's a gold standard. The gold standard is abstinence. And then there may be a path to that gold standard. But I think we need to expand our partnerships, right? So we offer, as a medical community, we offer the Suboxone and the treatment and this mental health and those things. But there are pastors, there's ministers, there's AA, there's, you know, it's not a one-size-fits-all. And there's a role for all these different programs. That's, I think, what we need to be expanding. Like, okay, you're not into Suboxone. Okay, how about this? How about AA? How about these other options that are not under my roof, but they're under the county's roof? They're available in our society, and there's something for everyone. It may not be just what I have to sell or to offer.
I 100% agree. I mean, what I hear you saying is basically offering different services to different people, because everyone doesn't need the same thing. And that's certainly something that I agree with. And that's what we're working towards in terms of that R95 initiative.
I love that. I love that. Thank you. And what's next for you? You've had a very creative, productive career, and you're continuing doing that. What are you passionate about next? Another movie? Another book?
I don't know. You know, I think there's a lot of new, exciting opportunities here in California, you know, new laws, other things that we're responsible for implementing. So that's really keeping me busy. I don't have any new films coming down the pike anytime soon. I just like to stay busy and I want to make an impact. So in any way that I'm able to do that, I think that's what I'm interested in doing. And I really appreciated the opportunity to talk with you today and kind of be on your podcast. I've heard about it. And, you know, it's exciting to talk to you about these really important, impactful issues that are impacting our society.
And thank you. Thank you so much for making the time. This has been a great conversation. It's nice to reconnect.
All right. Great. Take care.
Thank you for listening to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where you learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. This week's episode would not be possible without the generous support of our sponsor. A sincere and warm thank you to Physicians for Healthy Communities. Visit physiciansforhealthycommunities.org and view their video and resource library. High Truth's producer is Dave Rivas from Davey Boy Productions. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. We hope we brought your day a little bit more High Truths.